Sandy really works a great program. She's also involved in Al-Anon as well. She may tell you a little bit about that. And I know I need to hear more about that as well, but I still have some family members that, one family member who will remain anonymous, I promise. But please welcome Sandy.
Hey everybody, my name is Sandy and I'm an alcoholic. I'm honored and privileged to be here to tell my story. Thank you, Tim, for asking me, and I love you and I pray about you a lot. And anyway, I'm very nervous, so it'll filter out in just a few minutes the way it always does. But I want to read something to you guys from one of my other favorite recovery books. It's called Oh, the Places You'll Go by Dr. Seuss. Do I see any nods in the crowd? Anyway, he has some great recovery stuff, and I just want to read a little bit, and it kind of talks about the path that I've been through, and I just think he's really awesome. And I love it that in our book, Bill tells us to seek outside sources. Seek outside help, read books, check ministers, rabbis, get therapy, and there will be talk of outside issues in my story because this is my point of view and this is my story. So my hope, when I sat over there as we were reading, my prayer is always that something that I say that God has put into my mouth will help someone in this room to stay sober for one more day, or if you haven't ever been sober for a day, that maybe you can achieve one day of sobriety. And it's one day at a time. So anyway, it says, I'm afraid that sometimes you'll play lonely games too. Games you can't win because you play against you. All alone, whether you like it or not, alone will be something you'll be quite a lot. And when you're alone, there's a very good chance you'll meet things that scare you right out of your pants. We can read that any way we want, can't we? There are some down the road between hither and yon that can scare you so much that you won't want to go on. But on you will go, though the weather be foul. Oh, you will go, though your enemies prowl. On you will grow, through the cackens and howls. Onward up many a frightening creek, though your arms may get sore and your sneakers may leak. On and on you will hike, and I know you'll hike far and face up to your problems, whatever they are. You'll get mixed up, of course, as you already know. You'll get mixed up with strange birds as you go. I love that. So be sure when you step, step with care and great tact. And remember that life is a great balancing act. And those are all three in capital letters, great balancing act. Just never forget to be dexterous in death and never mix up your right foot with your left. And yes, you will succeed. Yes, you will indeed. 98.75% guaranteed. Kid, you'll move mountains. So if you've never read this book before, it's awesome. I wish I could read the whole thing, but, you know, we got to talk about me now. So, anyway, my name is Sandy, and I'm an alcoholic. I was born January the 8th, 1964. That makes me 46 years old. Not ashamed of that. Proud of that. Glad I made it. And my sobriety date is August the 8th, 2003. I was born in South Fulton Hospital. I'm a native Atlantan. I was born to very young parents who didn't have any idea what they were doing. And as I said, I was born in 1965. So my parents were pot smoking, motorcycle riding, freewheeling people, what people did in 1965, that's what they were. And they did the best they could with what they had. I used to want to blame my alcoholism on the fact that my mom was never at home for me at school and made me a sandwich when I got home. Nobody was ever there to help me with my homework when I got home. My parents were divorced when I was very young. You know, I had all these great reasons why there was a reason that my parents, I was an alcoholic because of my parents, not because of me. So, I grew myself up. I was a latchkey kid. My parents were divorced when I was very young, and I went from mom to dad to mom to dad, and I didn't have much discipline. I had no discipline. I disciplined myself. You know, it's hard to be put on restriction when nobody's there to enforce it. I was very freewheeling myself, you know. I mean, I made my own rules and I made things up as I went along, and I was always the rebel in my family. I was always the wild child, I guess you could say. And things, but I did good, you know. I mean, I completed high school. I got a DUI when I was 18 in 1984, and they slapped me on the wrist, and they said, you pay us the money and for a year, and then you're gone. That's $300. And I don't know how people afford DUIs now, because I hear they're pretty expensive. So, anyway, and when I was in high school, I was living with my father, and my father was remarried to a woman who wasn't very nice to me. And that was when I first, my first drug of choice was actually marijuana. It was easier to obtain, and it relieved that pain. But one day, I tried beer and alcohol and all that good stuff when I was about 15 years old, and I really, really liked it. And I grew up in Fayette County, and in Fayette County, they didn't have a liquor license, so we had to drive to this next town called Riverdale to get beer and wine. And we would drink as much as we could. It was about a 15-mile drive back, and that worked really, really good. And I had never felt enough. One of the memories that I have about never feeling enough was when I lived with my father, and it was cold. He always made me wear a sock hat to keep me warm. So I wear that hat all day long at school because I didn't want to take it off and people have to make fun of me because of the way my hair looked. Hello, you know. you know, the funny thing about it now is I love to wear hats and I wear them all the time and I really like them. But at the time, it separated me. It made me feel not good enough. And you know, also the stepmother that I had, you know, she shopped at the fine places for clothing, and I shopped at a little store. I don't even know if you guys remember. It's called Richway. You know, and I got my clothes at Richway, so I never fit in. You know, all the girls were wearing Jordache jeans and Gloria Vanderbilts and all this, and I was wearing my little, you know, Richway jeans. So I never felt like I fit in. And then when alcohol came into my life, all of a sudden I fit in. I fit in. I found a crowd that I got along with, and things went pretty well. And my goal in life was to become a bartender. And I had said I was going to do that from when I had the first drink. I thought, wow, this would be great. I can, like, drink and make money. So that was what I did. So as soon as I graduated, I became a bartender, and I absolutely loved it. I mean, there's nothing more powerful than having the substance that everybody wants, and they have to be nice to you if they want good drinks, you know, and they have to tip you well if they want really good drinks, you know. So it worked, not to mention the being on stage all the time. You know, I was the center of attention. I was the show. I was important, and I really liked it. And I was very, very successful. The last position I held in the bar business was an assistant food and beverage manager for the Westin Hotels. Unfortunately, the alcoholism was catching up with me by then, and I was doing a whole lot of, I never thought of myself as a thief, but I drank a whole lot of alcohol that I did not pay for. I gave away a whole lot of alcohol that I did not pay for. And every once in a while, some alcohol went home with me that I didn't pay for. So I was a thief. And that was a harsh reality for me, because I thought a thief meant I literally stole out of the register, which I did literally steal out of the register. So, you know, that worked really, really good for me. I don't like to talk a whole lot about the drinking, but I like to qualify myself with what my bottom was, because I think we're all real clear about the reason we're in this room. I don't really think we need to talk too much about the alcohol part. But I drank for 25 years, and about 18 to 20 of them were a lot of fun. Good times, good friends. Yeah, I'd have hangovers, and sometimes I'd make a jerk out of myself, and sometimes I'd be inappropriate. But really, the last 5 years were really, really, really where it got a hold of me, to the point that the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization began. And I got to where I got really angry when I drank, and I lashed out at the people that I cared the most about. And the last 5 years of my drinking were the worst, and I was in a relationship with someone who had his own faults, but he did not deserve the abuse that I put upon him. And I abused him for many, many years. And when I say abuse, I mean emotional, mental, and the downfall was physical. I was physically abusive to him. And one night I went out drinking, and I came home, and when I would come home, I would be expecting something. And when I wouldn't get that, I would get very angry. And for the last time, I physically abused him, and he had me arrested for simple battery. I don't remember much of that evening. It was pretty much a blackout. I remember little bits and pieces of it. But what I do remember is that I knew I was going to jail, so I went and got dressed. And then I went into my closet and proceeded to drink as much as I could before the police got there, because I knew I was going to be there for a while. So the cops get there, and there I am in the closet drinking. I don't normally like to mention the particular drink, but Grand Marnier was what I was drinking, and you can get pretty hammered on that. So I was really trying to get a bunch of it down. And, you know, I got up and got ready, and I just remember it felt like the cop was driving like a million miles an hour, because I was raging in the back seat of the car. And that was one of the little pieces that I remember. And then I don't remember a whole lot until about 3 hours after I got in there. And about 3 hours after I was in the holding cell, there was a girl that was sharing a cell with me. And she was a little bitty, small girl. And she didn't have any teeth. She was very frail. She was withdrawing from crack cocaine. And she, first of all, asked me for my blanket and then my apple the next morning. And eventually they separated us. And I was in the cell, and she was gone somewhere. But the next morning we came before the same judge, which was probably about 11 hours later. And this girl was in jail for solicitation of prostitution, which means she was doing what she needed to do to get what she needed to get. And I sat next to her in front of the judge, and she looked over at me and she said, "I don't know what you drank last night, but you stink." And it's funny, but it was also very, very humbling, because there were a lot of things leveled at that moment. One, that I realized that a drug addict was no different or no worse or any better than myself. And that was very humbling, because I had always thought I was better because I was a drunk and I drank good wine and expensive alcohol. And, you know, but I looked around and I noticed that we were both wearing the same orange jumpsuit. We were sitting before the same judge, and she told me I stunk. And that was the moment of clarity for me. That was when I knew that what I was doing was not working anymore. And I had to do something about it, because I hated myself. I hated hurting people that I loved. I hated feeling the way I felt. And I didn't lose a lot of things when I drank. Now, my car got repossessed, but I was grateful for that, because I didn't need to be driving anyway. As a matter of fact, I looked out one night and saw that it was gone, and I was just like, "Well, I'm going back to bed." And the boyfriend was like, "Well, we need to call the cops." I'm like, "Nah, we don't need to call the cops." I knew where that car was gone. You know, I knew I hadn't paid that payment in quite some time. I was surprised I had it as long as I did. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, I immediately got out of jail and did what every good alcoholic would do. I went and drank the rest of the booze that was left over, you know? And then I called this little place over on Claremont called the Atlanta Biscayne Room. And a wonderful man who's no longer with us, his name was Frank Crow, answered the phone, and he said, "Atlanta Biscayne Room, how can I help you?" And I said, I think I might need to come to a meeting. And he said, "Well, come on over. We got one at 6 o'clock. I was working at Lowe's over here on Peachtree Industrial at the time, and my lunch break was at 6 o'clock. And there was a meeting over there called Rush Hour that was at 6 o'clock. So there was God's intervening right there. And I went over and sat in that room and literally just vomited all over everybody every single day. I was so angry. I missed alcohol so much. I wanted to drink every minute of every day that I was in there. I was so thirsty, you know. And I knew that I wanted a better way of life, but I did not like the pain. I did not like the pain. But I did what everybody said. There were some people over there, the old timers over there. I mean, I tell you, it's really, really good to have some, I call them crusties. It's really good to have some crusty old folks around you, because they will not mince words with you. They will not put up with the whining and the crap. They will say, when you want to do something about it, when you get miserable enough, let me know. Until then, you know, and I was great. It used to tick me off, but I hung on, you know. It was like almost like, well, I'll show them. I'm going to continue to show up. And I did. And I kept showing up, and I kept showing up, and I got a sponsor. And she was really, really, really tough. I mean, like, she was the type of sponsor that I would call because somebody cut me off in traffic. And she'd say, well, did you pray about it? Read page 62 and call me tomorrow. And I was like, okay. You know, oh, it used to make me so mad, you know. And anyway, well, so what happened was I got really, really miserable. And I was about 110 days in. And I went to a doctor, and I told the doctor, I said, look, if you don't do something for me, I can't sleep, I can't eat, I can't think, I probably shouldn't even be driving a car. If you don't give me something, I'm going to drink. And that doctor gave me 10 Xanaxes. Yeah. Can y'all guess what happens next? She said, I don't feel comfortable doing this. I know you're in recovery. She said, but I want you to take one in the morning and one at night. I want you to get some rest. Take 3 days off. Da-da-da-da. Well, gee, guess what happened? First of all, I called my sponsor and said, yeah, you know, I think I'm going to be okay. She gave me some Xanax. I'm going to be cool, you know. And pills are not my deal. I just wanted some relief. I didn't care what it was. I just wanted some relief. So she said, oh, no, you can't fill that prescription. You'll drink. I was like, what do you mean I'll drink? They're pills. What are you talking about? You know, and the thing that I've learned about AA is, we have to learn. We have to figure it out, you know. And for me, anything that affects me up here in any way, I can't have. I don't even take, you know, NyQuil, Benadryl, none of that. It's all off limits for me because I just don't want to take the chance. And that's just for me. So anyway, I immediately told her that, you know, I was going to fill it, and I went in and filled it. And of course, I took two immediately. I mean, come on, you know, be for real. And then I basically took them over the weekend and did not drink. And then it was Monday morning. It was time for me to go back to work. I had one left, you know, and I was supposed to take one in the morning and one at night. So obviously, I was abusing them already. And I took that one, and I went to work, and I was pretty loopy, I remember. And I left for lunch, and instead of going to the trusty old Biscayne room, I took the other turn, and I went to the liquor store. And that was a very, very, very bad thing. I drank 2 gallons of wine on top of 10 Xanax over the course of 2.5 days. And, you know, and that's a lot for somebody that doesn't take pills. So, yeah, it was pretty bad. I did wake up. I was very grateful that I woke up. And talking about a hangover, oh, my gosh. It was like every hangover I ever had combined together all at one time. All at one time. It was the worst experience I ever had. I was sick. The detox from that was horrific. I sweated. I would put a shirt on and I would just sweat. Everything was just not staying in. It was really, really bad. I do not recommend it. And my apartment looked like I had a party with about 20 people. I was drinking red wine. There was red wine all over the carpet. Furniture was tipped over. My smoke alarm was knocked off the wall. And the weirdest thing of all was that there was one single footprint in red wine underneath my bed. I know, right? I mean, I still cannot figure it out. I mean, I go back. I mean, of course, I was in a complete blackout. I remember pulling the cork out of the second bottle because, you know, no matter how low I got, it had to have a cork in it, okay? But I don't remember anything else. And I was told some very unsavory things that I won't share in this group that happened while that occurred. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization in a blackout. Not good times. Anyway, I called my sponsor about a week later, and I was like, I drank, and she was like, oh, really? What a shocker. And she told me, oh, I saw that coming way back. And if your sponsor's ever said that to you before, pay attention, because it's true. It's true. And I say to people that I sponsor, when I say things to you that seem offensive to you, I'm saying it because I've lived it and I've experienced it. I'm not saying it to be hurtful to you. I'm saying it because I get it. I've been in that spot. So I picked up a white chip. And by the way, I had beaten my own self up during this relapse. I had bruises from head to toe, and I had a carpet burn on the whole right side of my face. So I walk into the Biscayne room to pick up my white chip, and I knew that everybody was going to hate me. I knew. I was like, they're all going to hate me. They're not going to want to have anything to do with me. They're going to be ashamed of me. And it was a Saturday morning. And I went in, and yeah, they laughed at me. They did. They were like, good Lord, what did you do with yourself? You know? And I was like, I don't really know, but it didn't feel too good. I'm pretty beat up, and I think I want to try this again. And after that meeting, a gentleman sat me down, and he said, I want to tell you a story. I said, okay. I was willing. Whatever anybody wanted to do, I was willing. He said, there was a girl that used to come here, and her name was Mel. Mel was a little bit younger than me and a bright, bubbly person, and she left the meeting one day, and she went home in her apartment, and she drank herself to death, and she died. And she stayed alone in her apartment with her dog for several days before anybody found her. And I didn't know this person, but she saved my life. I didn't want to die. I didn't want my parents to have to come and find me dead and bloated in my apartment. I did not want to die. And that was when it really kicked in for me. And that was August the 8th, my original sobriety date, or I should say the first day that I came into AA was April the 17th. And then my sobriety date is August the 8th, 2003. And then I decided to get into action, and I did. I got into action. I did whatever my sponsor told me to do. And I went through the steps. I remember doing my first four step and fifth step with my sponsor, and we met in her basement. And we got on our knees and we did the third step prayer. I felt nothing. I was like, really? Really? I thought I was supposed to feel something, you know? And I did feel a sense of relief after I eliminated a lot of stuff. And my first sponsor and I had a lot in common. And she was going through some personal issues, and she was great. I mean, she literally saved my life that first 9 months because I needed somebody really tough. And she was going through some personal issues, and she became unavailable, so I got my second sponsor. And my second sponsor, the funny thing about my second sponsor is, I'm cool, is that she was Jewish. And I'm a Christian. And I thought, well, this will never work. You know, I mean, come on, you know, how will this ever work? Because I was new. I didn't realize that all that was cool yet, you know. And my second sponsor taught me more about God than anybody thus far has taught me about God. She would say things to me like, you're a child of God. God loves you. God wants good things for you. You're a beautiful child of God. And I didn't believe anything she said. I was like, yeah, right, sure, you know, because I did not feel redeemable. And the thing about my second sponsor that made me angry, and I mean, she's the most kindest, sweetest person I've ever met in my life, but the thing that made me really angry was when I had finished with my other sponsor, I had my 8-step list, you know, like in my hands, like I was ready, you know, like walking around, like I gotta go around and tell everybody how sorry I am, you know. And she was like, oh, no, you gotta start all over again. You don't know me and I don't know you. And I'm like, what? Are you kidding me? Come on now. And she was like, no, for real, you got to start all over. And I was like, okay. So we went all the way through the steps again. Now, she didn't make me rewrite my 4th step, and she didn't make me rewrite my list, but we went through the book, and we did the deal. And when we did that 3rd step prayer, and this is for me, I believe that and that 3rd step prayer, when you pray it with someone and you pray it in sincerity and you pray it on your knees, something happens when it's ready. And the thing about the Jewish religion that I did not know was that Jewish people do not pray on their knees. And I did not know that. And she got on her knees and she prayed that prayer with me. And man, when we got through, I don't know what it was, but it was all over me. I mean, I had goosebumps on top of goosebumps. And I knew when we stood up, I was just in tears. I knew that I was going to be okay. I just knew. You know, I mean, I can go right back to that moment right now. And it was such a beautiful moment. And we hugged each other. And wow, you know, I mean, I hope everybody gets that feeling at one time in this program, because it is awesome. It is one you wish you could put in your pocket in a little vial and hand it out to people when they're having a bad day, you know. It's just that warmth that... It's cool, you know. So then we went on with the step work, and we went on into the 8th and 9th step. And the thing I remember about the 8th and 9th step with my sponsor was we did some burning of some stuff, because there was a lot of things that I had done when I was drinking that due to the nature of it, I wasn't going to be able to go face to face. And that was hard, because there were some of them that I really wanted to go face to face and I couldn't. So we did a lot of like burning stuff, which was cool. You know, I mean, we you know, I wrote the letter, exactly said exactly what I wanted to say. I read it to her and then we burned it. And you know, burning stuff's fun anyway, you know. We went out in the front yard and with the grill and burned stuff, you know, put gasoline on it. It was great, you know, because smoke rises, you know what I'm saying? So that was a really good experience. And she taught me a lot about getting quiet, and she gave me this book. Like I said, there's going to be some things I'm going to talk about that are not AA. She gave me this book, and it's called The Language of Letting Go. And it has been one of the most valuable pieces of literature outside the big book that I have ever experienced in my life. Other than Dr. Seuss, too, of course. But it really, really helped me. It helped me to learn how to be kind and to be gentle to myself and forgive myself for a lot of things that I was unable to forgive myself about. Because just because I do, like the 4th and 5th step and the 8th and 9th step, doesn't mean that I forgive myself. So I went on with her until I was about 5.5 years sober. And then I met him. Him. Yeah. Met him in an AA meeting. I'd never seen him in an AA meeting before. And over at the Biscayne Room, they have a bar in the back of the room. Bar stools and everything. You know, it's awesome. And I looked over, you know, because I'd really been wanting to be in a relationship. I thought, wow, you know, I'm almost 5 years sober. I mean, you know, I deserve this. So, I went over and I introduced myself to him. And I proceeded to go through a few years of hell. And don't take me wrong, guys, because I love men. But I know how to pick the ones that are not very good for me. And I'm real good at that. And I have another sponsor who says that people, I forget how she said it, but she said something like, I said, well, I met him in an AA meeting. She said, you would have met him if it was the World Series playoffs at the Fulton County Stadium. You would have met him there. And I'm like, really? She's like, yeah. There's like a magnet. There's some sort of magnetism. You know what I'm talking about, don't you, Hazel? That's who said it. Anyway, so you know, I don't like to, I don't like to talk much about that. But what I want to say about it is that it was very, very hard for me when it broke up, and I didn't know what to do. I'd never been, A, gotten in a relationship sober, much less gotten out of a relationship sober. You know, what I used to do is, okay, you move out, I'm going to go to the bar and move the next one in. And that was just the way I did it. So I got really, really, I didn't know what to do. I was talking to people. I was going to meetings. I'll tell you, this 9:30 meeting here, this literature meeting, saved my life. Literally saved my life, because I went through a huge depression. I did not know how to get out of it. And I woke up every morning and I said, God, if I can just get to that meeting, if I can just get to that meeting, I'll be okay. And I just clung on to little things, you know, little nuggets that I got here and there. But I couldn't get rid of the sadness. So I sought outside help. And that outside help was a blessing, another gift from God. And she started saying, you need to go to Al-Anon. I'm not going to Al-Anon. I'm not doing it. I go to AA. I go to CA. I'm in therapy. I'm not joining another damn fellowship. I'm not doing it. And I fought it. And I fought it. And I fought it until I got suicidal. And when I got suicidal, I knew that I had to do something. I was as miserable, stone cold sober, as I was the moment that I walked in at the Biscayne room. And I don't know if all you have experienced this, but there's not much worse place to be than being stone cold sober and wanting to kill yourself. It's horrible. It's horrible. I mean, there's no way out. And so, you know, and this was after over a year of therapy. And so I said, okay, I'll do it. You know, because I got to get real friggin' miserable before I do something different. Anybody like that in here? Can y'all get down with that? So I was miserable. So, you know, I know this is AA, but, you know, Al-Anon is a part of my story. And I came into Al-Anon, and I'm slim now, and I was about 20 pounds thinner. I wasn't eating. I wasn't sleeping. I didn't want to drink, and I didn't want to use. And the next God moment came along, and our buddy Terry with the long ponytail that comes here, I started talking to him about this. I was in his house a lot, and I started talking to him. And he said, well, you need Al-Anon. I said, okay. I said, I've been thinking about that. Funny you should say. And several other people have mentioned the person's name to me. And Terry said, I'm going to call somebody for you right now. I said, okay. You know, and he picked up the phone. Do you mind if I say your name? Okay. And he said, Hazel, I got somebody that needs your help. And I got on the phone with Hazel, and three other people had mentioned Hazel's name to me before I ever met Hazel. So God intervened there and gave me an Al-Anon sponsor that taught me how to love myself again. I love AA, but Al-Anon taught me something that AA didn't teach me. You know, and that's just the truth. That's just the truth. I love both programs. They saved my life. So I went through the steps on the other side of the coin, for God's sakes, you know. And all this time I was sponsoring girls, man. I mean, you know, When I went through the breakup, I went on sponsorship tour 2008, 2009, 2010. At one time I was sponsoring 12 girls. There was no time for Sandy. I was barely getting my work done. I was running from over here to sponsor this girl, from over here to do this, to go over to here to meet this girl, and fielding lots of calls every day. Plus, I run a business. Plus, I had a life, but I had no life at the time. And I needed that, you know, because I was in so much pain, and staying busy kept me sober. Helping those other girls kept me sober. Doing that service work kept me sober. So I just kept plugging through, and within about 3 months of being in Al-Anon, something shifted. Something shifted, something changed, the depression lifted, it went away, and then I started, like kind of where I am right now, is I started living my life. And, you know, I got happy again, and I got joyous again, and I got free again, you know. And I had to do a lot of step work, man. I mean, God, the resentment pages, I mean, just insane, you know. And I thought, and there were times when I thought, I'm just never going to get better in this area. I'm just always going to make bad choices in this area. And I wanted to give up. And I wanted to stop. But I just kept on plugging through, and I kept on plugging through. And what I'd like to share about how it is now, like right now, I can honestly say that God has been so good to me. I mean, wow. You know, just the gifts and the blessings that I've had. And not even big stuff. I mean, I'm just talking about, like, noticing the sunrises and the sunset. I was on a beautiful golf course today with a dear friend. You know? Great way to spend that. Rather than being like, oh, I don't have a boyfriend for Valentine's. I'm out with one of my best friends playing free golf. Free golf. Not just golf, but free golf on Druid Hills Golf Course. I mean, you know, that's pretty good life from somebody that, you know, drank in a closet and waited on the cops. You know, that's a pretty big change. So, I have in the last few years, the biggest things that have happened to me was that I really started to like myself again. I started to take pride in myself. I actually started wearing makeup. Some of y'all noticed. I actually started doing my hair, you know. I am a motorcycle enthusiast. I love motorcycles. Going to buy myself one very soon. I love to play golf. I love my cat. I love my friends. I have some of the best friends. You know, Butch that came up here and read. How many times have I told my story? I don't know, 30. Butch has been there every single time. Except for when I told it at a women's meeting, and he would have came if he could have. And he would have loved it. But, you know, I mean, this is the person that, you know, I mean, I could probably just go, why don't you just come up here and do this, and I'll sit in the front and watch, you know. And we've grown together, and, you know, I haven't, and that's another thing that I've learned is that you can be friends with the opposite sex. And you can love the opposite sex. And you can grow and grow with them. And I have, God, you know, I mean, it's just so hard for me to put into words the things that have happened. Last year, my mother was diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer. She had to have a mastectomy. And I was able to go to the hospital and be. And B, I didn't know what to do. I had to call somebody and say, what do I do? What do I do? Because I was always drinking. I was always too busy to go to the hospital or to go to a funeral or to go to a wedding. Well, unless there was liquor. Free, open bar, I was there. I was there. And I, my sponsors, they said, you just go and B. I go, well, what do I say? You don't have to say anything. Just go. I did not know that. I did not know that. And she's doing great. And it was. That's another thing that I want to touch on is my relationship with my mom had always been very volatile. And you know, I guess you women can probably all get down with that. It's like, you know, your mom's either your best friend or she makes you crazy, or a little of both. And for the longest time, I had hoped that my relationship would be repaired with my mom because I was not there a whole lot, and I harbored a lot of resentments against her that I was never able to express. And ever since she went through the cancer, something shifted in her. And I had nothing to do with it. You know? I had nothing to do with it. But I used to, like, talking to her on the phone for 5 minutes used to be torture. And now we can talk on the phone for 30 or 45 minutes. And she has this gratitude and this something that wasn't there before. You know, God has moved in. And she was like me. She was always believed in God. And she just made bad choices, too. I mean, my mom used to say, looking at you is like looking at a mirror at me. You know, man, that used to enrage me. Be like, what? You know, and now I totally see it. And I'm okay with it because my mom is a strong woman. You know, she's courageous. I mean, I saw her. My mom is like me. She has all this hair. And when she went through chemo, I knew she wouldn't lose her hair because she had too much of it. There's no way. And when she did, it was very sad. I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. But now she has this soft, beautiful, fine, baby-like hair, you know. And I'm like, wow, that looks great. And, you know, and I'm just sharing these things because I can be grateful about even the fact that she went through that and there was a purpose, and I can see it now because it softened her and it did something to her and it changed something to her. And I didn't do anything because I used to try to force it on her. So my relationship with my father has gotten a lot better. Yeah, I'll share this story and then I'll shut it down. When I was, 2008, I went to go visit my dad, and I played my first round of golf with my father that I've ever played in my life. My father had been holding on to this piece of jewelry that was supposed to be mine, and because of his mother passed, my grandmother, and it was a charm bracelet. I don't have it on tonight. Sometimes I wear it when I speak. But anyway, I had never gotten that piece of jewelry, and I knew why I'd never gotten that piece of jewelry. And I was playing golf with him, and the next day we were sitting in the living room, and he came in, and he handed me a box. And in the box was the bracelet. And let me tell you, it wasn't about the bracelet. It didn't have anything to do with the bracelet. It was that my dad knew that I was okay. He knew that I was okay. And he told me so. And he told me why he never gave me that bracelet. I knew. So that's one of probably the biggest things that's happened to me in sobriety. And that doesn't seem that big, you know, but it's huge. It means they trust me. It means, I think what parents want to know, I don't know, I'm not a parent, is I think they want to know that their kids are okay. Isn't that what they want to know? And they know that I'm okay. And I thought that since it was Valentine's Day, I need to say something about love. I know nothing about it. I'm the boyfriend-girlfriend. I know how to mess it up, so if you guys want any suggestions on that, I'm free after the meeting. However, I have learned that you have to get the love from where it is able to be gotten from. As Hazel says, we don't go to the hardware store for bread. They don't have bread at the hardware store, which means I don't go somewhere where I can't get my needs met and then not get my needs met and then be resentful because I didn't get my needs met from someone who can't meet my needs. I think it's called unreasonable expectations. So I've really learned a lot over these years, and I am just ever so grateful to all the 12-step programs, and I'm just thumbs up for any type of recovery. So if you're new and you're struggling and you're hurting, hold on one more day. Do one more thing. That's what Jack said last week that I took, or week before that I took home. Didn't one of you that said that? Just do one more thing. Go to one more meeting. Make one more phone call. Share with one more friend. Cry with one more friend. And I love that. And that was a nugget that I took. And that's the other beautiful thing, is that I can't get everything from... I have two sponsors, so I got double accountability for one. But I can't get everything from either one of them. That's why I need you guys. I need God. And I need the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to help me live my life to the best of my ability, one day at a time. Thanks a lot, everybody. I appreciate it.
Seven traditions state that their names are no dues or fees to AA membership. But your generous support makes a big difference to us. You're flat broke. Maybe like you. Maybe not.
Whatever you can afford to give us, we'll take it. And I'd like to ask Julie to come up and give out the chips.
All right, we have a chip system here at this meeting and at Nevin. lots of places in Atlanta. Marks our time in sobriety. Does anybody here want a white tip? It simply means that you're surrendering for one day and deciding not to drink for one day. Anybody? All right. How about a silver tip for 30 days and nights in a row? Anybody else have a silver 30 days? Anybody? Okay, how about 90 days, 3 months? I think they call it 90 days in case you get sober starting in February or something. You try to cheat a couple days off of it all. Okay, 6 months. Anybody have 6 months? 9 months. Just green. Anybody have 9 months? Okay, how about birthdays? Anybody have a birthday? All right. Thank you, Sandy. I really honed every word. I really did. I learned a lot. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Julie. What are we doing here? Okay, I guess it's time for AA related announcements. We had a great dance right here Saturday night. I don't know when the next one is. What we got, Frank? Anything? Frank? Got anything to announce?
February 26th, someone's having their speaker meeting.
Oh, okay, yeah, there's a dinner and speaker meeting on February 26th on Saturday, 6:30 p.m. is the dinner, speakers at 8, and the guest speakers from Savannah, Georgia, by the name of Charlie White. Thank you. Yeah. Charlie, yeah. Kind of famous? Okay. I'm the last one to know. Yes?
There's a men's meeting that takes place every Saturday at 5 o'clock on Heaven News. We're at a new location. Finally got a home. We're at the Serenity Club. It's on 1943 Morland Avenue in Atlanta. The marker for that would be there's a drive-in right across the street from there called the Starlight Drive-In. And the clubhouse is actually the old liquor store. It's really a spiritual spot. There's other meetings that take place there as well. If you have any questions, call me up.
The heavy hitters on Friday night.
Saturday.
Okay. Thank you, Kenny. Next week we've got Eugene M., sober since 93, has been a president of NAVA Club. He's a member of the 1:30 p.m. Think It Through Sober Group. What?
Yeah, Tim, I'm not a problem. Two things. Remember the NAVA website. Tim and Ms. Donnett work together. Now, we've got around 100 speakers you can listen to on the NAVAClub.org website. And also, somebody's given us a whole bunch of free Valentine's cards. If I was a girl, hey, if you want to grab one, if you haven't got one, to
Or stash one for next year. Or for your mom. Okay, again, Eugene M. tells this story next Monday night, and then on February 28th, Julie Mack tells her story, and she's in the 9:30 I can't. Group. And gives out chips. Just perfect. Just great. Okay. And I guess that's all for tonight, unless anybody has anything else. I'd like to remind everybody that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. For those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer. Take a moment of silent meditation. for those suffering inside and outside this room. Who always makes a great need?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. 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 Amen.